When I came to the end of the last tape, I was talking about Sid Woods. I was reminded in doing so of the fact that I'd forgotten to relate in proper sequence another episode having to do with Sid Woods, which I meant to put in and forgot. I suppose that most people in their lives have a certain number of memories of things they've done and wish they hadn't, of things they've said and wish they hadn't. And this is one of those episodes. I did talk, I remember, about how generous and nice Sid was to me the times I saw him on leave in Sydney. I also now remember that at the end of that leave, we were somewhere. Perhaps still in Sydney, I don't know. But we were returning, and we were in a taxi cab with at least three other pilots and people that I knew, and Sid Woods was one of them. And he said something about this girl that he had been seeing down there and taking out every night and so on. And what possessed me, I'll never know. Actually, I do know, but I'll come to that later. But following his remarks, I said something like, well, she was probably nothing but a whore anyway. I don't remember the first thing he said, but it was a remark calling me down for saying that. And then he added, I probably would have married her if she would have had me. And as usual in these cases, a terrible silence fell over the cab. Everybody was embarrassed for me, and I was embarrassed at having said such a stupid thing. And, well, that's the end of that. But I've always bitterly regretted having made that dumb remark. The truth of the matter is that most of the pilots in Sydney on leave did spend their time with not whores, actually. They were just what some people term friendly girls. And as a man I used to know used to say, oh, she only does it for her friends, and she hasn't an enemy in the world. Well, these weren't professional whores at all, but they were girls who spent their time picking up Air Force personnel and going to bed with them. And a good many of the people that I knew from the 7th Squadron spent all their time screwing in Sydney. And I must say, I don't blame them. I had no objection to it then. Wouldn't have today. All I'm telling you is that there was some underlying basis for that remark I made, and evidently in this case it was wrongly applied. Anyway, I'd give a lot never to have said that. Another little incident I remember from that return trip from Sydney was the fact that we all spent the night in Port Moresby when we got back to New Guinea. And as I had mentioned at the time, with us was the group commander, Colonel Selman, with whom I had shared a room at the Australia Hotel. And we got back to New Guinea too late to go across the mountain to Dobadira that day, and so we spent the night there. And we assembled the next morning at Ward's Aerodrome and to get a plane over the mountain. And the troop carrier people had an operations office there, and they arranged to get people rides. And they had a sergeant there in charge of all that. And so when we lined up there and to give our names and stuff, and when they got to me, I for some reason, just one of those things, when I was called upon to give my serial number, which I knew just as well as my name, and I still do, I absolutely couldn't think of it. And there was a long, embarrassing pause, and of course, the longer and more embarrassing it got, the less I could remember what my serial number was. And the sergeant looked at Colonel Selman, and he said, "Well, Colonel," he said, "there's one in every crowd." I don't remember any more about that, but we did get across the mountain, serial number or no serial number. Another little irrelevancy I might as well insert here as anywhere else, because I forgot it in this proper time, but a very interesting thing I noticed one time when I was driving Blackie Cosby back to Oro Bay, and we went through this flat countryside for a while, and the Army had, as far as I can tell, had brought over some tractors and things and had plowed up huge amounts of land. I don't know how huge anymore, but 50 acres or more, I'm sure of that, of land, and had planted it in vegetables. And I thought at the time, and still do, how clever that was, because here was all this good fertile land and lying unused, and here were all these troops who needed food and fresh vegetables, which were unobtainable, actually. And so they thought, "We'll grow our own," and that's what they were doing. And they had two farmhouses out there cultivating these long rows of vegetables. Never heard of anything quite like that before or since. In fact, I didn't hear about it then. I saw it. The natives had little patches of gardens all over the place, but they were just little bitty things that were smaller than most people's gardens at home, seems to me. Well, that probably is not true, but they weren't very big. You could see them from the air all over the place. The native men, by the way, wouldn't work in those gardens. The women had to do all the work. But the men did stand guard around there to protect them from marauding tribes, I suppose. Used to see them all the time as you drove down the roads. At this time, there was an episode which took place, and which was one of the more exciting and nicer things, though, goodness, there were a lot of them, but this one was particularly nice. One afternoon, or one morning, I guess it was, when I was not on alert, in other words, I was not flying that day, Captain Manning and some colonel from Fifth Air Force came up to me in a Jeep. Jack Farrell was with me. And the colonel said, we want you to take a safe hand message up to Kirawina. A safe hand message was a message that was, I suppose, probably top secret and something they didn't want to send this message by radio or any other means. It had to be written and hand carried and hand delivered. Kirawina was a small island in a group of islands called the Trobriands, Trobriands. And the island, the only one of any size at all in that group, was Kirawina, Kiriwina. And it was very strategically located because it lay almost directly, not quite, but almost directly between the bomber path from Port Moresby and Dobadira to Rabaul. And of course, Rabaul, up at the end of New Ireland, I don't mean New Ireland, I mean New Britain, was the prime target for all the bomber activity around there. That was the place they pounded night and day and had for over a year. Anyway, Kirawina was big enough for a landing strip, and it was a strategic thing because bombers and fighters both that had been mauled in the fighting over Rabaul and felt they couldn't make it home over all that open water could always, in case of necessity, if they could make Kirawina, which was more than halfway home but still a long way from New Guinea, could land there and save their lives and airplanes. The base, such as it was, on Kirawina was manned by the RAAF. And apparently, the day after the colonel talked to me, they were laying on, as the British say, a big bombing mission on Rabaul, and the safe hand message that I was entrusted with had to do with instructions relating to that bombing mission. And the colonel said, I'm going to give you two copies of this message, and I want you to take somebody with you. And you take one copy and let your companion take the other copy, and one of you will get through, no doubt, and you are to deliver these to the commander there at Kirawina. So two P-40s were assigned for this mission, and as soon as Manning and the colonel drove off, Jack Farrell said, take me. Well, there was nobody I would rather have taken than Jack, and I was delighted and flattered, I guess, that he wanted to go. So I gave him the other copy of the message, and we took off about 1 o'clock. And, of course, neither one of us had ever been to Kirawina before. It was all out in the open sea, far from any land. But we knew about where it was, and I don't remember at this time whether I tried to plot a course or not. I doubt it. I doubt if I had a map. Any such thing. I imagine we just lit out, I guess. Anyway, we did light out or whatever, and we got very close to Kirawina, but ran into bad weather. And this bad weather was extremely local. Well, we were in the sunshine and all, and then all around the islands, the Trobriands themselves were nothing but pouring rain and clouds and stuff right down to the ground. We couldn't get near it. And So we turned south, southwest, and headed for a rather large island in the, well, I won't even attempt to say it, but we headed for an island called Good Enough Island, all one word, Good Enough. Good Enough was a fairly big island and was very beautiful. South side of Good Enough was high mountains, quite high, really. And the north side was all just a sort of level plain. And they had an airstrip there, paved, I believe. But anyway, whatever it was either paved or had that metal matting. But it was a long strip, like 6,000 feet. And perfect approaches from the sea at both ends, and it was all quite fine. The weather was fine there, so we went back to Good Enough and landed and hung around there for 2 or more hours, I suppose, and about 4 o'clock we decided to make another attempt because the bad weather at Kirawina looked temporary. So we flew back up to Kirawina. It was easy to identify because it was surrounded with all these clouds. And we flew around and around. You could completely encircle these things. By these things, I'm talking about the clouds, the bad weather. But right where we needed to go, there they were. And just as I was about to give up and go home, a hole opened up, and without any ado whatsoever, just abruptly as hell, I could see this little strip down there. I just dumped wheels and flaps and went in with Jack close behind me. Unhappily for somebody, when we were just about to land, we encountered a B-25 coming in from the opposite direction, also just about to land. But he pulled up and went around, and we went on in and landed. It was pouring rain, just torrents. But it was clear enough to get on the ground, and we did. What the B-25 did, I'm not sure. But I know that the operations officer bawled me out for doing what we did, but I really don't much apologize for it in the first place. We had something important to do, and we had to get in there, and we weren't in any communication with anybody on the ground, or were able to be, that I know of, or that we knew of, and no harm came of this thing. I'm not recommending it, but anyway, that's what happened. And we delivered our message, both of us. Jack gave him his copy, and I gave him mine, and the mission was accomplished. But the weather closed in immediately after we got down, and there was no question of our being able to get out that night. So the RAAF just put us up for the night. And we had supper with them, and they were very nice to us, very nice to us, and treated us well and fed us well. And the Australians and that includes the RAAF, they are very loose in their language at most times, but they follow strictly the old military rule, which used to apply in the U.S., I believe, but certainly didn't when I was in the Army, that you're not supposed to use bad language at mealtime. Anyway, I remark on this because it's one of my favorite little recollections that night Jack and I went to bed early. It was pouring rain, and we were under one of these corrugated sheet iron roofs, and so it really sounded nice. And there was nothing else to do, and we just went to bed. But we weren't sleeping. We lay there talking. And out of the silence, suddenly Jack said, Dill, he said, you know why I like to eat with the RAAF? And I said, why, Jack? And he said, 'cause they don't say shit at the table. I guess I agreed with him. Anyway, the next morning blossomed, full of sunshine and not a cloud to sky. And so after breakfast, Jack and I took off for Dobadura. We had made up our minds that since our belly tanks were empty, or would be by the time we got back there, we would put on an acrobatic show over the field when we got back, and we'd show those people back there what was what. When we went out to get our airplanes, however, there was nobody around, no mechanics or anything, and so we did our own pre-flighting and drained the water out of the gas and all that stuff. And but you have to remember these were rather new P-40Ns and had no electric starters, which meant they had to be hand cranked. Well, that was all very well for one of us, but wasn't all very well for the other. So what we did was that Jack cranked up mine, and when I got the engine running and all, this is absolutely the most unaccepted procedure in the world, but I don't see we had any choice. And it got the engine running and warmed up and idling all right. I just put on the brakes and everything and got out and left it sitting there without anybody in it with the engine running. And I went over and cranked up Jack's plane. And when his engine got running, then I went back to my airplane. We took off and went home. But unfortunately for our plans, when we got back there, the weather was quite bad, and there were clouds low and everything, and we did well just to come in and land, and there was no question of doing any acrobatics. Actually, we could have done them, but they would have been above the clouds. Nobody would have seen us, so what was the use? That was a nice little mission. I always enjoyed it. I enjoyed going to Goodenough, and I enjoyed going to Kiriwina. And it was a variation from the routine of the day. One time, the 5th Air Force laid on a kind of lecture for us. They brought in a man who worked for Standard Oil and had worked for Standard Oil in New Guinea before the war for some years, and he was very familiar with New Guinea, and he was familiar with how to get around on the ground. And the purpose of his talk that night was to familiarize us with a number of do's and don'ts if we got shot down or forced down for any reason and had to make our way back home the best way we could. I don't remember most of the things he told us, but I do remember this. He remarked on the fact that all the rivers in New Guinea and all of the ponds and lakes in New Guinea were infested with crocodiles. Well, I more or less knew that, though I hadn't had any personal confrontation with any of those beasts. But he told us, he said, crocodiles don't like fresh meat, and if they catch you, they'll take you out in the river or the lake and take you down near the bottom and spin around and around with you to drown you, and then they'll bury you in the mud. And when they figure you've gotten rotten enough, they'll dig you up and eat you. And the other thing he said that I remember was, don't ever try to outrun a crocodile, because although crocodiles can only run a very short distance, in that short distance they can run faster than you can, and if you try to outrun them, they'll catch you. Climb a tree or do anything, but don't try to outrun them. I'm happy to say that I never had occasion to have to try to do that. But we did have a man in the squadron, a tall, lanky fella named Lee. And Lee got shot down or forced down or something or other in a lake not very far from Dobradura, but that lake, like all the rest of them, was infested with crocodiles. But he had a life raft, and he inflated it and got in that life raft and was attacked, or threatened, I better say, threatened by crocodiles. And a lot of the guys in the squadron went around there making passes on the lake, shooting at the crocodiles to scare them away. And all I remember about that is that when it was all over and Lee was rescued, he said, well, I was a good deal more scared of goddamn P-40s than I was of the crocodiles, and I wish you had just left me alone. One day, I remember, we had an air raid in the middle of the day, and I wasn't on alert that day, and for some reason, I was out in the middle of the airfield complex. This was an area, a cleared area, where we had really three strips all running in a sort of Z pattern, roughly. And there was a hell of a lot of cleared land around there. And for some reason, I was out in the middle of it. And the air raid alert went off, and it wasn't phony, as it often was. They were coming down there, I mean the Japanese, to bomb us. And I will never forget that awful feeling of being out there in the open, because, for one thing, of course, the airfields were the prime target. That's what they really wanted to bomb. And I was in the middle of their prime target, and there was nowhere to run. And wherever you had to run, the distance was considerable to get anywhere, even remotely safe. Anyway, I ran. And in any way, furthermore, they didn't bomb the strip. They got attacked by whoever was on alert that day and driven off. But it was a horrible feeling because, as I said, there wasn't anywhere to run. Anywhere that you could reach in reasonable time. And it was a helpless, hopeless feeling, I'll tell you. There was another time, and it may very well have been that same day. I expect it was. When one of the few times that I, quote, witnessed, unquote, air-to-air combat from the ground. And the P-38s mostly went in there and took them on. And it was all directly overhead. But it was so high, you couldn't see anything. You couldn't see any airplanes, except every now and then the sun would catch on the glint off the canopy of somebody's airplane, and you could get these little flashes and glints. And you could hear the gunfire from the airplanes. You could hear that. And every now and then you'd see airplanes falling. But as far as just actual combat, airplane to airplane, you couldn't see anything. You couldn't see anything at all. It was very exciting. I can tell you, it was very exciting. Sometime around about this period, Americans and Australians laid on a big trooper invasion of the Markham Valley up above Leh. It was such a big operation, it was the first time this had ever been done in the Southwest Pacific, and one of the few times even anywhere, and General MacArthur even came up there to witness it. But I suppose they decided they couldn't leave a big base like Dover Dura totally undefended, although they needed all the airplanes they could get. But who was left behind to defend Dover Dura except the 7th Squadron? And you never heard such cursing and swearing and muttering and grumbling as on that occasion. I don't know who else besides us was elected to stay behind and do nothing. Maybe nobody, I don't know, but I know we did. And maybe the 8th Squadron, but...